Okay, so thanks a lot for being here. And thanks a lot to the organizers for giving me the opportunity to come here to California. It's the first time in my life, so that's nice. Okay, by the way, I must say that I'm not paid by Scuola Normale, otherwise my boss, if she hears the talk, she will complain. I'm actually paid by the Italian CNR, but I work at Scuola Normale, but the salary and the money comes, unfortunately, from CNR. Okay, so these are the people that are really done the work. It's my PhD students. In a year or so, they will look for they're actually starting to look for a postdoc position. Fantastic people, Marco Gibertini and Alessandro Principi. And then I have a former student who has been working on something else with Peter Zoller in Austria, but we still collaborate a lot and is coming back to Pisa. Andrea Tomadin, and then more senior people, Paco Guinea, Misha Katznelson, and Alan McDonald, and Paco and Alan rear around. And I really acknowledge collaboration with Victor Geringer and Markus Morgenstern as far as experiments is concerned. Okay, so I've divided the talk into three parts. I have just a small introduction because we've had fantastic STM talks. Practically everybody doing STM on Graphene is at this conference, so I don't need to say too much about that. I want to raise like a couple of points that are important as far as theory is concerned. And then I will essentially give, I will talk about two recent papers that we have put up in the archive. So like in December, one has to do with the fact that it's going against common wisdom, the fact that you read in many, many papers that you have to have electron hole paddles. It's a sign that you have charged impurities, and we will we don't think that that's a necessary condition for electron hole paddles. And I'll talk you. I will give you a couple of examples of which one is of experimental interest in the sense that we used really STM data for the height fluctuations for a graphene flake on silicon dioxide from Markus Morgenstern. And I will tell you how we do these calculations. Once you give us like an height fluctuation profile, we can give you predict what are the electron hole paddles. And that's why I would like to get some input from the experimental groups, since there are both things. So there are topographic maps that tells you what are the height fluctuations, but there are also a lot of maps that we have seen about electron hole paddles. So to close really the loop and nail down if this is just science fiction or not, we need to do some more work. That's something I should say. And the last part of the talk has to do with the fact that even in a perfect graphene sheet, just in the presence of electron-electron interactions, there are no Dirac cones. V-shaped density of states is not there as soon as you switch on electron-electron interactions in the absence, complete absence of external sources like disorder of phonons, for example. And this has to do with this keyword that was put forward a long time ago by Lundquist. It's called plasmarons composite particles between composites between holes, essentially, and plasmon collective density oscillations. We have heard a talk by nice talk by Misha Fogler about plasmons and how plasmons are important for plasmonics, and they don't emerge only in the in a two-body correlation function like a density-density response function, but they have been seen also in a one-body response function, which is essentially one particle Green's function, which is what angle-resolved photoemission spectroscopy measures in a pretty recent experiment by Eli Rodenberg and co-workers. And the point I want to make is that these electron, these whole plasmon composite excitations have a very important role also on the STM spectra, because the STM spectra is nothing more than an integral over all momentum of the ARPES spectrum. So if these plasmarons are real, and that's what Eli is seeing, they should be in STM experiments. They might be masked a little bit by disorder, but they must be there as they must emerge as sample quality increases. Okay, and then I will give you some summary and conclusions. Okay, so I really don't. We've heard a lot about maps and electron hole paddles. This probably is actually the first experiment by Jens Martin and co-workers showing this beautiful breakup of the carrier density profile into electron hole paddles. And essentially, the whole idea of this is a single electron transistor probe, but the idea is the same when you do like STM as we've heard today. So you have a sharp feature in some quantity that you can measure In the SCT case, it was like a compressibility that tells you what the Dirac point is, and you follow that as a function of space, so you know how the Dirac point is shifting in space. And from the shift of the Dirac point, you can reconstruct actually a carrier density profile. And I want to stress that this reconstruction actually uses a single particle theory, or if you wish, Thomas Fermi approximation. So all I'm saying is that EF minus ED, which is shifting in space, is H bar V times KF, that tells you what is the local density. So when you write down this equation, you want to promote that to a local level. This is local level. That's a Thomas Fermi approximation that you are using actually to reconstruct the electron hole paddles from these local measurements like SET or STM. And it's not guaranteed at all that that will work, so it's something that we have actually checked, but I'll go back to this point in a moment. And also we have seen already these plots in the talk by Mike Cromin, which by doing STM, he was able essentially to look at paddles and to find out actually strong scattering centers correlated with electron hole paddles, which are essentially these red crosses. And then we've also seen data by Brian this morning. It's just a flash, essentially, pretty much all that is around in the literature. Okay, so that's as far as a disorder is concerned. And as Mike said this morning, there has been already evidence about electron-plasmon and electron-electron interaction effects emerging in the STM spectra on exfoliated graphene flakes on silicon dioxide. The features are kind of small, so that's why they take like second derivatives. It's not the DIDV plots in which you see those things very clearly. You have to do like a second derivative of I with respect to V, and they recognize that there are features that you see here labeled by D1 and D2, these solid colored nice black lines. So these are DIDV spectra, second derivative as a function of sample bias for different gate voltages. So as you change a gate voltage, you're changing the carrier density. So since they move with carrier density, it's very likely that those are effects which have to do with electron-electron interactions. And notice essentially these black dots you see here is the position of the Fermi, the position of the Dirac point. So the beautiful thing about STM is that they probe not only the field portion of the spectra below the Fermi energy, which is here at zero, as ARPIS does, but they also probe the empty states. So you can see a very nice correlation. So for n-doped samples, these feature, which have been attributed in this paper to electron-plasma interactions, show up only in the field portion of the spectra, while in p-doped samples, these features show up only in the empty portion of the spectra. And that's perfectly in agreement with a theory that we did about ARPIS spectra in the past, and I will come back also to this point later. This is a boron nitride, and I just want to mention that sample quality is so nice that there are features here and this nice peak which is emerging close to the Dirac point and in these samples, and you don't need to do second derivative of I with respect to V. You can just look at the IDV and you see this nice little bump that shifts with gate voltage. Okay, so that's pretty much all I wanted to say about the introduction, and I want to now shift to the first part of the talk, trying to convince you that Coulomb impurities and charged impurities are not a necessary condition to see actual electron paddles. And I was actually very happy to hear that, for example, even I made this kind of statement. So conventional wisdom in the literature is that electron hole paddles really are there because there is a random distribution of charged impurity centers, which are pretty much located close to the graphene flake. And you can read a lot about this in this very nice review of modern physics that appeared recently. So the key point in excluding the impact of corrugations on electron hole paddles is that people say, so if there is a topographic corrugation of one spot in space, space. I must see something in when I do the reconstruction, I look at the carrier density profile. So this locality actually is wrong, and theory says, as I will show you, that this locality is not actually there. So it's not so easy. You see a topographic feature, and then you say, I want to see some electron hole paddle there. So that's actually incorrect, and that's actually common wisdom. And so I really believe that there is no consensus that the physics of paddles, maybe about paddles being mainly due to charge scatterers. Of course, if you put intentionally charge scatterers, they will create and contribute to the paddles too. But intrinsically speaking, I think that there is an effect also by ripples. And so difficulties with the charged impurities being the main scattering mechanism have been raised by two experiments. One, which is an experiment by the Manchester group, Ponomarenko et al. In 2009, and there is a nice also experiment which actually is able to go by using this dielectric here to very low temperatures that show pretty much that are increase in orders of magnitude as a function of temperature. When you go from room temperature down to liquid helium temperature, essentially these Alberto Morpurgo and co-workers don't see any change in the resistivity. But I'm not an expert in transport, so I will just this is just an invitation really to read this paper. What I don't understand about paddles, it's pretty much summarized in this slide. So these are local density fluctuations that we can calculate with very sophisticated theories. If, for example, you tell us where impurities are. So these white spots are precisely the scattering centers, the red crosses you saw in Mike's Cromie slide, and the slide I showed before. So we can locate exactly charged impurities in space, as Mike says, where Mike says they should be, and then they can be at a certain average distance from the graphene flake. Okay, so what I really don't understand is that to have smooth pattern of electron hole paddles like the one Mike sees, for example, theory says, and these calculations at least say, that you have to put impurities at an average distance, which is 5 nanometer at least, away from the graphene flake. Okay, so but typical input parameter, typical distance that people use to fit transport data are distances between impurities and graphene, which is of the order of 1 nanometer. Okay, so we can artificially locate the charged impurities on a plane which is only 1 nanometer away from the graphene flake, and what we see is that the paddles are extremely sharp, pretty much strongly concentrated on each impurity, and that's easy to understand what's happening if so you have Coulomb impurity, the potential created in momentum space is 1/q, and to have the density delta n, you have to multiply the density response function that grows due to interband fluctuations like q times the external potential of a Coulomb impurity, which is 1/q. So q times 1/q gives you 1, which means delta n in momentum space is completely flat. That tells you that delta n in real space is extremely concentrated. In fact, this delta function of position r, something which has been said over and over, when you are in the subcritical actual regime. And so this is something that I really don't understand. I mean, if to fit all transport data, you need and you believe in Coulomb impurities, and you have to put a distance between impurities and graphene of 1 nanometer. I don't understand how you can get very smooth paddles. So this has been really out. It has been in our laptop for many years, and I've been saying on the archive soon many times is I don't know if we'll ever be on the archive, but I will put it on the archive. So Eros has done a great job summarizing a little bit elasticity theory for a two-dimensional membrane. So I'm going to shift gear, forget about this dispute about Coulomb impurities or not Coulomb impurities. Let's imagine we have a rippled graphene flake, and let's imagine that a nice experimental guy can give you the height fluctuation profile H of R that tells you, which is a two-dimensional, of course, map. You know, just plotting it as a 1D map, but in reality, it's, of course, a 2D map. And the idea is that assuming equilibrium, actually, which means that you allow strains, in-plane strains, to relax, can you do an effective theory that tells you what are the in-plane deformations as a function of the height profile h of r? Because as we have heard from Eros, essentially, the components of the huge of the deformation tensor uij tells you what are the scalar and the vector potential acting and coupling to your electronic degrees of freedom. So the idea is to come up with a theory, and once as an input you use h of r and you assume equilibrium that gives you what are the scalar and the vector potentials that the electrons see. And I must say that there is also a nice paper by Doron Gazit, who is actually in the audience, as a nice rapid communication, PRB 209, and we share several of our conclusions with his paper. So you go through the algebra. We have seen already this functional here, the elastic free energy functional, which contains in general bending rigidity, and these two other terms which are controlled by the deformation tensor, and lambda and mu are two elastic Lamet constants, which are known very, very well from work by Misha Katznelson and Annalisa Fasolino, for example. And in all I'm saying, I'm going to neglect the bending rigidity, because that's important only at length scales, which are of the order of 1 nanometer, but we are looking after paddles, which are of the order of 20, 30 nanometers. So this term can be safely neglected, and it's actually important only at short length scales. This is pretty much the only theory slide I have, and this is the second one. So you can this is really the last one. Yeah. Okay, so this is essentially the end. After you do this minimization procedure, you can get essentially a relationship, which is a pretty complicated relationship between the Fourier components of the deformation tensor uij, and essentially this, which I learned yesterday discussing with Paco and Doron Gazit, which is a Gaussian curvature in the context of a general relativity or something like that. We've heard a lot about also by Maria, and as I said, the key input here is this tensor field Fij, which depends on the map H of R that we need as an input from experimental groups. And the scalar and vector potentials, once you know the deformation tensor, can be calculated following, for example, these two nice papers out there. The only doubt, the only source of uncertainty in this procedure, okay, first of all, you have to believe the elasticity theory, but there are two coupling constants which actually relate the scalar and the vector potentials with the deformation tensor, called here G1 for the scalar part and G2 for the vector potential part. And this G2 is very well known, no doubt about it. But G1, there is a large source of uncertainty. So if you read in a paper by Suzura and Anu, if you look at graphite transport data, people believe that G1 is extremely large, of the order of 20 or electron volts or so. But there are a very nice calculation by a Korean group, actually ab initio calculation, that says that G1 must be much smaller than that. So for us, it's a tunable parameter, and a tunable parameter in the sense that since it's controlling the scalar potential, the smaller G1 is, the smaller the scalar potential is, the smaller the amplitude of the density fluctuations are going to be. If G1 is larger, that's fine. It will not change locally the structure of the electron hole paddles. It will change only the amplitude of the density fluctuations. And so the key theory difficulty here is the fact that it's screening, essentially. So G1 equal 20 is some sort of a limit in which you are neglecting, if you wish, screening, but electron-electron interactions screen actually G1, making its value smaller. And since the theory I'm going to talk about as electron-electron interactions and screening, at least the one coming from pi bands, we believe that the actual value of G1 should be used is on the smaller side. And you know, Paco and other people have done a lot of work on vector potentials. I believe that the scalar part has been not really considered into detail. It will have an extremely important impact on the electron hole paddles. I can tell you a priori that there are very solid theoretical arguments, like Farris theorem. I don't want to go into details, that tells you that the induced density coming out from a purely vector potential is essentially negligible. So I'm gonna put the vector potential there together with the scalar part, but there are very strong arguments and also nonlinear or linear arguments based on linear response theory. You will not have electron hole paddles. It will be a very weak effect on the carrier density profile coming from the vector potential only. So the scalar potential is really important. Okay? So what is the theory now? So we have a scalar potential and the vector potential, and in 2008 with Allen and then later on with Misha, we have set up a theory that, if you wish, calculates the induced density profile for massless Dirac fermions by doing some sort of effective density functional theory. So this is not an ab initio density functional theory that starts from the carbon atoms. It's based on the continuum model. So we use massless Dirac fermions, so sigma dot p Hamiltonian, then there is a minimal coupling of the orbital momentum p with the vector potential a coming from, for example, from corrugations, and then there is a part which is actually proportional to the identity matrix in pseudo spin space, which is a scalar potential here that contains three contributions actually according to well-established theorems like Hohenberg-Kohn theorem and other theorems of basic foundations of density functional theory. So one contribution to the Kohn-Chern potential is the external potential you give me can be given by charged impurities, or in the case of the talk today is the scalar potential I was talking about. Then there is the Hartree term, which is essentially the fact that electrons, even at the classical electrostatic level, will screen these external perturbation. And then there are subtle quantum mechanical corrections to this potential, which in the jargon of density functional theory, they are called exchange and correlation corrections, which have to do with the quantum nature of the electron of the inhomogeneous electron system you're looking at. And essentially you have to solve self-consistently this equation here, which looks like a normal Dirac equation in the presence of external scalar and vector potentials. However, the many body effects enter via self-consistently, essentially because both the Hartree term and these quantum mechanical corrections depend on the carrier density n, which is calculated from the orbitals. So this is a self-consistent calculation, and the only approximation which is actually entering into this theory is a local density approximation for the exchange and correlation corrections that for parabolic band electrons has been established to be extremely safe. And it's completely nonlinear theory, so if the potential is pretty large, you cannot apply simple linear response theory. So this is completely beyond the realm of linear response theory. So we have applied this theory to the case of ripples, and this is pretty much the most important result of the work. So you see here a sample whose height fluctuations shown here as a height fluctuation precisely has been given to us by Victor Geringer, and you can exactly see this look at this sample in this nice paper by Geringer, Markus Morgenstern, and other people back in 2009, in which they were able to see that ripples in graphene and also how they are related with the ripples in the substrate. So once you give the height map and you rely on this elasticity theory, you can calculate scalar and vector potentials, as I said, run our self-consistent code, including completely screening an electron-electron interaction, and you end up with the paddles here, which are shown in this color scale. And I will show you some two-dimensional plots, which are much clearer. And these are precisely, this is a scalar potential. So for a coupling constant G1 of the order of 3 electron volt, the scalar potential induced by ripples in a realistic sample like this is of the order of 40 milli electron volt, for example, and these are the x component and the y component of the vector potential. So once, as I said, you give me once you calculate these quantities, then you can calculate the paddles. So what I'm showing here is precisely the local density distribution, carrier density distribution, showing the paddles, and the two panels refer to the two values of G1 I was talking about. You have a question, Volodya? Okay. You found a mistake?
The reason why membrane will follow the surface is
Yeah, okay, so the only thing that I can say is that the membrane does not follow the substrate perfectly, in the sense that precisely in this paper by Morgenstern, it says that there are pretty large areas of the membrane which are not following actually the substrate, but it's true that there are spots in the sample which are actually attached to the substrate. Paco, you want to say something? Okay. So as I was saying, so these are for the two values of the G1 coupling constant, and the units here of the density fluctuations delta n are in units of 10 to the 12. 10 to the 12. Yes. Here, for example, these contour plots that we put on top of this plot are just contour plots of the height map, just to show that there is not a definite correlation between the position of the electron hole paddles and, for example, the height of the map. There are no, correlations with the Laplacian of the surface, for example. In general, I will show you another example in a moment, and the reason is that the scalar potential created by these strains, as you have seen, essentially goes like 1 over q squared, the small distances, if you look at this in real space, is a long-ranged kernel, log r minus r prime times a function of r prime. Doron does not like this language. I like to say it's non-local because to me it reminds like the electrostatic interaction by between a bunch of like current-carrying wires. So instead of being like Coulomb charges, it's like these current-carrying wires, log r minus r prime. So it's very high non-local functional in my electrostatic language, and so this argument of like killing ripples as a mechanism of electron hole paddles only because they are uncorrelated to topographic features, I think is not there. And this was already in our paper with Annalisa and Misha back in 2010, in which we didn't have a real sample at that time. We had the samples from molecular dynamics simulation that Annalisa had. And here you can see a beautiful manifestation of these a highly degree of non-locality. So the color map on the left is precisely telling you what are the out-of-plane topographic corrugations, and the reconstructed density profile that we can calculate has nothing to do with the height fluctuation map. So it's not because you have a bump here you expect certain electron hole paddles in that neighbor. So more mathematically, if you wish, the key point is that in some dimensionless units that we used in this paper, for example, it's true that the height of plane fluctuations are like order of magnitude larger than the in-plane fluctuations, but they enter quadratically in a nonlinear fashion in the deformation tensor. So which means that at the end you mix everything with everything, because these in-plane components of the atomic displacements end up being of the same order of magnitude of this other term, and this is also another way of saying what I was saying about non-locality. Okay, so now I want to change a little bit discussion topic and switch off completely all sources of all sources of disorder, and I want to talk about tunneling density of states, so DIDV maps as a function of energy in the presence of electron-electron interactions. I really got interested in this partly because we had these data a long time ago in 2008 about spectral function calculation of k and omega, and as I said, density of states is just an integral over all wave vectors of the ARPES spectrum. Also because I heard a nice talk actually in a conference organized by Paco in Benasque by Aaron Kapitulnik and Zi Shan, in which people for topological insulator, like Bismuth telluride, topological insulators, they have done a serious consistency check between the ARPES spectrum measured in the Shen lab and the STM spectrum measured by Kapitulnik. And I don't think that this has been done on a single sample like graphene. So there is different groups doing everything. Nice thing what I like here is that this was done in the same spot on the same sample. And Aaron Kapitulnik was saying, you know, all my colleagues tell me this should be Dirac fermions, but I find this a large background here. The density of states does not vanish if I have Dirac fermions. Density of states should be V-shaped and vanish at the Dirac point. And electron hole puzzles have actually been seen also recently by Ali Yazdani group. And also there, they see DIVDV maps, which don't vanish. So you have to do some procedure of extrapolation to understand where the Dirac point is, for example. And V-shaped density of states exist, though, in some nice experimental setups. For example, graphene flakes on graphite. This was already in my talk before you gave your talk. I didn't put it on purpose, but it's a nice, beautiful example of a V-shaped density of states. And there are very nice data by Ari Manohar and Stanford showing very nice V-shaped density of states for artificial graphene samples created by arranging in space on copper 111 atoms. One by one, creating an artificial lattice. And essentially, density of states vanishes, and as I will show you, I mean, it's these systems are highly screened, and I think that's what's killing these background that I will talk about, which is induced by electron-electron interactions. So this is some sort of that was some sort of motivation to publish this. I wanna I don't wanna talk about this because I've already talked too many times, but it's really where the input of the theory is. So here in this slide, essentially, I'm showing very nice experimental results by Eli Rothenberg and co-workers showing that there is a huge reconstruction of the Dirac spectrum in very high quality graphene samples, which have in this particular experiment created by on silicon carbide, and they are hydrogen intercalated, so you can, you know, essentially lift up the graphene flake and decouple it from the substrate, thus enhancing, in my opinion, electron-electron interactions. And what you see is that you don't have a simple Dirac cone. So the simple picture of a Dirac cone is actually shifted. If you want, there is a cartoon here of the final result. There is appearance of satellite bands, which have to do with this electron-plasmon coupling or Lundquist plasmaron, actually. So you have crossings between quasi-particle bands that form a Dirac point, a position here in energy which I called E0. There is crossing between these satellite bands, which have to do with electron-plasmon interactions, that cross at an energy E2. And there is even a one-dimensional ring here, which forms in the middle, and this nice diamond shape. And I think this has been really seen by Rothenberg in his experiments. And we did, again, a theory back in 2008. And this is also some nice work by the Maryland group that, you know, despite the fact that Maryland group cites only the Maryland group theory, I want to really highlight that this is also nice work that they did in 2082. Okay, so A of K and omega, you integrate over K and you get tunneling density of states as a function of energy, and this is precisely what I'm showing here in this plot, this density of states as a function of energy. Units are extremely important in this plot. I'm scaling energy omega here with the Fermi energy, and density of states with the density of states of a non-interacting system of massless Dirac fermions. So my nice density of states linear in energy. And what you see is that it's a V shape at high energy. Actually, the slope here of these bands is strongly affected by velocity renormalization. So if you increase your coupling constant and the strength of electron-electron interactions, the slope goes down because quasi-particle velocity is enhanced, actually, as we heard a lot. But in correspondence of this diamond feature, which have to do with this reconstruction of the spectrum, you see that there are, for example, two minima. So what do you call Dirac point in this case? And there are also some nice peaks, which I believe is what Mike is seeing, for example, on boron nitride. This slide is precisely for strength of electron-electron interactions, which is suitable for graphene on boron nitride. And these are instead, so these panel here on the left shows the dependence of these feature in the tunneling density of states as a function of coupling constant alpha, the famous fine structure constant of graphene. It changes as you change substrate. And magically, I must say that the largest contrast of these peaks is not because boron nitride is so popular now. You do the calculation without even knowing what boron nitride is. It's magically that the contrast of these plasmaron peaks in the density of states is largest for a value of coupling constant alpha 0.5, which is what's believed to be the number for graphene on boron nitride. And the last thing which I want to say is that I mentioned that velocity renormalization in the slopes, you increase alpha, which means you enhance more and more velocity, and the slope of the density of states goes down. But there is also this very nice background, which is completely due only to many body effects. And as you can see, scaling the density of states with the non-interacting density of states, that goes like the Fermi energy, essentially the background doesn't change. So this background, you can experimentally check, should scale if it's due to many body effects, precisely, almost precisely like the Fermi energy, even though there's a slight dependence on fine structure constant. Then how big is this background? I mean, scales like the Fermi energy. So if you go towards the undoped limit, it will not be there. But at a fixed doping, how big it is, okay? So simple calculation we did, just to conclude, is you can calculate density of states in the absence of electron-electron interactions, only on the presence of disorder. Since I want to compare like potatoes with potatoes, we took here Coulomb impurities, whose their coupling with electrons is given by the same coupling constant alpha, and you can essentially see that also Coulomb impurities will generate eventually, at least within these self-consistent Born approximation, they will generate a finite background. But to have a comparable background with that given by electron-electron interactions, you would need the impurities density, which are, for example, for graphene on silicon dioxide or on boron nitride, like twice as large as the electron density. So this just gives you a feeling of how dirty your system should be to have a background in the density of states, which is as large as the one given by many body effects. And that's it. And sorry if I took more than I was supposed to take. Yeah. Thank you.
Hi. Very nice talk. Just a quick comment rather than a question. So like for this, let's assume that you have charge impurities, and you'd say, you know, the distance is too small to make sense for your maps. But, you know, I think in reality you have a three-dimensional distribution of charge impurities, and so we always call this D an effective distance of the charge impurities from the graphene layer. And so in order to then make a theory that is doable without too many fitting parameters, we use a fixed D that we say, an effective D, and then we do some coarsening. Okay, so we take a continuum distribution of density of charges, and so that's how we get to maps that make sense and have a, you know, correlation length of 10 to 20 nanometers.
Okay.
So that's just to reconcile a little.
I just wanted to get this clear. So you're saying for the transport, it the calculations need the defects to be 1 nanometer, and for the STM 5 nanometers on average. Is that what?
So
that's the numbers that you were.
That's the number I was saying.
I understand that he just said something different.
No, he said that D has to be interpreted as an effective distance because they are distributed.
But I just want to make sure I understand what you said.
Yeah. So what I said
you
is
said
that
1 nanometer versus 5.
Yeah, versus 5. Okay. 5 to have smooth electron hole paddle. So
I one thing I was just kind of curious, because I know that Michael Fear's group has been doing these nice measurements. Where is he? Of the actual impurities on silicon oxide using Kelvin probe. I'm just curious, did those measurements say anything about how deep the impurities are?
So I have two comments. One of them regards the impurities. Since you took into account the lattice relaxation, in principle, you can think about the possibility that the lattice will relax due to an impurity, which will then change the polarization operator. So I don't think that one can really jump into conclusions without doing the full calculation.
Jumping into which conclusion?
That charge impurities cannot create big electron hole puddles like...
Did I ever say that?
I thought you...
I said that it's believed that common wisdom is that if the puddles mean essentially charged impurities.
I meant in the sense of the transport. Just comparing the numbers is due to the polarization operator, which will change due to lattice relaxation. And another thing, just to clarify the correlation. So for the experimentalists, it's easy to follow, to get the electron hole puddles from topography just by multiplying the local radii of curvatures. This multiplication will exactly follow the electron hole puddles, and it's easy.
No, I agree with him. We have discussed this yesterday, so.
Okay, so. If we assume for a moment that the dominant mechanism of formation of these puddles is your mechanism, there's an issue of how conductivity depends on the concentration, on Fermi energy. Would it? What is the scattering mechanism?
Yeah.
Then?
So so it's not only charge impurity. There are other mechanisms that would give you roughly sigma linear in N, and frozen ripples, for example, are believed to give you sigma which scales with N. But probably, and one of the authors is here in the audience. But that's one possibility. But I'm not. I don't want to give the impression that we understand what's happening. I just want to give the. I just want to tell you this very simple thing that if you have if you see puddles, does not mean necessarily that you have electron hole that you have charged impurities.
No,
but frozen ripples and resonance scatterers are alternatives actually to Coulomb impurities, and they also give you a density dependence conductivity that is roughly linear in N modulo logarithmic corrections or.
For STM spectra, does the plasmaron peak work in the same way as in the case of ARPIS, or what selects the energy of the plasmon, the wave number of the plasmon in the STM case?
Absolutely the same origin. So it's matching between quasi-particle group velocity, which is the Fermi velocity, with the plasmon dispersion that Misha was showing. So exactly the same mechanism. In fact, the theory is exactly the same. It's A of K and omega. So the same mechanism I was giving you, the strong coupling between holes and plasmons, is precisely matching quasi-particle group velocity with the plasmon group velocity at some given wave vector Q that depends on fine structure constant alpha.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. First of all, I like to comment on comments that topography does necessarily give strain, especially if you use relaxation. So it would be confusing if experimentalists would compare puddles with topography. You need to compare puddles with strain, unlike Doran said. Okay. And the second one, when are you going to estimate transport mobilities from the strain you induced?
When somebody teaches me about transport, So I don't know. How do you put this in transport calculations? Is
let's go to the session format.